It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we find out about the latest twist in the King Veteran Home story, with a state budget veto raising questions about the operation of the Wisconsin Veterans Facility.
First, it's time for our weekly look at national news. The rifts between the president and other key Republicans have become increasingly apparent this week. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson seems to have fallen out of favor with the president after reports that Tillerson had called him a moron. Trump proposed an IQ test face-off between himself and Tillerson.
And Republicans in Congress, like Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, have also drawn criticism on the president's Twitter feed after Corker publicly criticized the job Trump was doing as president. A very public back and forth has raged on between the two.
You can share your thoughts on that by calling up at 800-642-1234.
Perry Bacon Jr. joins us now to look at those stories and more. He's a political writer at 538. Perry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Let's start with this story of the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Reports coming out that Rex Tillerson had referred to the president as a moron a while back. What have we heard from the president since then?
So we heard, as you referred to, the president in an interview with Forbes magazine, in which he said the story was not true, but he also said that there's an IQ test that he thought that the president thought that he would outperform Mr. Tillerson, which was a moment in history we have not had before, at least we could say. And so now at this point, the president has again today said the president and Mr. Tillerson met yesterday. And the president has been saying now they have a good relationship and they're getting along well. But all the reporting and all the things I know suggest that's not the case. And there are some real tensions here between Tillerson and the president still.
And here's Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, what she had to say about this.
He wasn't questioning the Secretary of State's intelligence.
Well, he made a joke.
Maybe you guys should get a sense of humor and try it sometime. But he simply made a joke. He's been extremely clear time and time again, despite the fact that you guys want to continue to bring this up and create a story. He's got 100% confidence in the Secretary of State.
People, including Senator Corker, have pointed out that there have been substantive policy differences. The big story before this one with Rex Tillerson was Rex Tillerson saying, yeah, we're negotiating with North Korea. President Trump saying, sorry, you're wasting your time, and seen as undercutting his Secretary of State. Is that the main actual policy disagreement we've seen?
No, there's a lot of them. I mean, if you think about the way Donald Trump talks about foreign policy, he talks about it in terms of, you know, he's a nationalist. And he, I remember his old advisor, Steve Bannon, talked about how they oppose globalists. So think about Tillerson was more supportive of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, for example, which the president got out of. Tillerson wants us, or is more favorable toward, the Iran deal that President Obama negotiated, which Donald Trump very much opposes. You heard that Tillerson wants to talk to North Korea. The president wants to use sort of much more bellicose rhetoric about North Korea. So I think they're on issue after issue. Tillerson favors a kind of a more mainstream, traditional foreign policy, and Donald Trump does not. You talk about NAFTA, which Donald Trump does not like as much as Tillerson does. So we can go on issue by issue, where to some extent, not just Tillerson, but also Secretary of Defense Mattis, Chief of Staff John Kelly, National Security Advisor McMaster. There are, like, you know, there's a lot of tension between Trump's national security advisors, who kind of want to maintain a more traditional American foreign policy, and the president, who wants to be much more of a disruptor.
There were reports that Secretary Tillerson had considered resigning over the summer. He denied that. The White House denies it. The president says he has confidence in Rex Tillerson. Is there talk, though, that this might not be a relationship that lasts?
Yeah, I mean, I have not personally confirmed that Tillerson says he wants to resign, but the New York Times and NBC News have. So I take their word that he's considered resigning. And the thing in Washington is not sort of like, is at this point, the question is like, how long will Tillerson last? Tillerson's been talking about staying for at least a year. So I think he might do that, but I would have a hard time seeing him be Secretary of State this time next year. I think that will be very unlikely, because there are like core policy differences.
Perry Bacon Jr. is with us from 538, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's move on to Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. He has said, hey, I'm not running again. I'm not running for re-election to the Senate. He has freed up his language some in how he talks about President Trump. Here's a little bit of what he said about the president in a phone interview that both sides acknowledged recording with New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like he's on a reality show of some kind, you know, when he's talking about these big foreign policy issues. And you know, he doesn't realize that, you know, that we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
So fairly strong stuff from a senator in the president's own party. So what's ensued since then?
I mean, not just a senator in Trump's own party, but Bob Corker was considered for vice president. He was also considered for secretary of state. He's been, you know, from, I would say, January till July, one of the closest senators in the Republican Party to Trump. So this is like a big break, and one that Trump has taken very personally. You saw he attacked Twitter. He attacked Corker on Twitter on Monday or on Sunday. He referred to Corker as little Bob Corker, because Bob Corker is probably not among the most tall senators. He made fun of his height on Tuesday. So this relationship has gotten worse and worse in the last few days. I would note one thing is that a lot of reporters have tried to reach out to senators in since Corker's comments. What the senators have basically said is they don't want to take sides here. That is an important thing to say, because you have Bob Corker, the senior senator, who has basically suggested the president is dangerous for the country and is kind of reckless on foreign policy. And senators are basically not commenting. So think about that. They're not really defending the president of their own party, who is being accused of not really understanding foreign policy and potentially starting World War III. That is very telling that they won't really defend Trump at all.
And Senator Corker said, hey, if you could hear what goes on behind the scenes in the Senate, basically a lot of Republican senators are thinking the same thing. They're not, if they're thinking about running for re-election, they don't appear to be ready to come forward and say what Bob Corker is saying, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's not news that we've had John McCain, Ben Sasse, Susan Collins. There have been members of the Senate already who have been pretty critical of Trump. So nothing. And, you know, in my interviews with people in Washington, anonymously, there's great doubts and great worry about Trump. The doubts are about whether he is engaged enough in policy, but the worries about specifically how he's handling the North Korea issue and if he's making it more dangerous, increasing the risk of some kind of attack launched by North Korea against the U.S. So there is real worry, and I think Bob Corker is expressing something very bluntly, other people have said privately. The key thing, of course, is Bob Corker is not running in 2018, so he's free to say things that I think other senators will not say.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie. Charlie, can you hear us? We do not have Charlie on the line. Looks like we should, but I think the gist was he's saying Trump is talking tougher on North Korea. Charlie's saying, hey, we've got this status quo. We've been trying diplomacy with North Korea a long time. Maybe we need tougher talk in the line of what Donald Trump has said. I think I've summed up what Charlie was shooting for there via my producer. Is that the argument from the Trump administration and its supporters? Like, hey, we've got a failed policy on North Korea. We might as well try something different here.
I think that's exactly the argument Trump has made, and not just on North Korea, by the way. There's a lot of issues where, like, I think this Tillerson versus Trump thing has been covered a lot in terms of, do they have a personality conflict? I don't think it's necessarily about that. I think it's much more, and with Corker as well. Corker and Tillerson are fairly aligned on foreign policy. I don't think they would pull out of the Iran deal themselves. I think they are worried about the way Trump talks about North Korea. I think Trump is trying a different course on foreign policy, and some of these distinctions are really about differences in policy and not necessarily personality views.
We're talking to Perry Bacon, political writer at 538.com, looking at the top stories in national politics this week.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about a rift between the president and other key members of his party, people like Secretary Tillerson or Senator Corker? Do you agree with any of their criticisms of the president? And are you keeping an eye on the new GOP tax plan? You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234.
We'll get to that tax plan coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our look at the week in national news with Perry Bacon, political writer, at 538.
You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. We'll be talking about the Republican tax plan. Do you think Republicans will manage to pass something? What are you hoping for when it comes to changes in the U.S. tax system? And how about your thoughts on how the federal government responded to the devastation in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Perry, you wrote about Republican efforts to change the tax system. You write that in some ways, this is harder. There are more divisions among Republicans than there were on health care.
Right. So if you remember the healthcare process, there was basically this one core divide. There were some Republicans who were more on the left side of the party, like Susan Collins, who said, I want to keep some parts of Obamacare, like the Medicaid expansion. And then you had some pretty conservative senators like Rand Paul, who said, we should repeal the whole thing. And the whole 9 months was basically fighting about that difference in position. That was basically just one issue, though. You know, there was a lot of issues embedded in that, but that was basically one fault line. Versus on tax policy, you have a couple different fault lines. First, you have the senators who are saying this cannot increase the deficit. And I think the leader there is Mr. Corker, who we were talking about earlier from Tennessee. He's been saying we cannot increase the deficit anymore in our tax plan. So that's a big stance, because right now, it looks like the plan they've come out, according to some analysis, would increase the deficit substantially. So that would change the plan a lot. And the second thing is a lot of Republicans want to use this tax plan to simplify the tax system, meaning they want to reduce the number of tax brackets from about 7 to 3, and they want to get rid of a lot of tax deductions. The problem with that is a lot of tax deductions save Americans money. And so you've seen some estimates already saying a lot of middle-class Americans would pay actually more in taxes than they currently do under this system. So a lot of the members, particularly one of the big issues has been the plan right now put out by the Republicans would not allow people to deduct their state and local income taxes as they can now from their federal returns. And so you're seeing members from states like New York and New Jersey that have fairly high local tax rates say, basically, I can't vote for that because my constituents' own taxes would go up. So you have that divide as well, and that's a really important divide. So you have the deficit divide, but you also have the kind of how the tax code will be redistributed and who will get the money and who will lose out. And those are two potential big challenges.
And the way they're trying to do this in the Senate, it's similar to the health care bill, as I understand it. They're doing it through a process that means they just need a simple majority, or basically 50 right. votes plus a vice presidential tiebreaker if need be. They don't need any Democrats on this.
They don't need any Democrats, but as we saw in health care, when you need, basically they have to have all but two Republicans vote for this by that method. So you saw with health care, three members of the 52 could kill the bill. And I think that's where we are now, where you already have, if you're passing the bill with this very narrow margin, it means basically three senators have veto power, and it's very hard to pass a bill that way.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Julie is on the line in Menominee. Julie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a thought on Senator Corker's comments about the president, and I identify as a Democrat myself, but I wholeheartedly agree and appreciate that man for having a voice and speaking out and expressing his concerns openly. And it's really been quite a disappointment for me in seeing the rest of our government essentially fail in doing that, in speaking up for the safety of our country, and it just shows such a lack of integrity for me, and I'm worried and I'm scared. And only one senator here and there is brave enough to actually express those concerns openly, and their silence is just deafening.
Julie, thanks for the call. And Perry, if Senator Corker is right, and a lot of his colleagues feel the same as he does about the president, their same concerns. Talk about the politics behind that decision to speak out or not, the risk of a primary challenge, say, for a senator seeking election in the next 2 or 4 years.
Right. I mean, what you've seen is Donald Trump's approval rating among Republicans is about 70%, 80% in some polls. That's not great, because usually in your own party, people like you. Obama, throughout his term, had about a 90% approval rating among Democrats. So Trump is not as popular among Republicans as Obama was among Democrats. That said, 70 or 80 is still bigger than 20 or 30. So the risk of incurring the wrath of Trump supporters is a real one. And you can tell an example of that, because in Arizona, there's a senator named Jeff Flake, who actually wrote a book that criticized Trump in pretty scathing terms. He now has a primary opponent who's running as a Trump ally, and it looks like Jeff Flake may have a hard time winning the Republican primary even. So I think there is a big risk here.
Julie, thanks for that call. I want to move on to another couple issues before we're out of time, Perry. The response to Puerto Rico still concerns the media spotlight isn't there as much, but concerns that something like in the neighborhood of 10% of people now have power, for example. Speaker Paul Ryan is leading a bipartisan group to Puerto Rico after a disaster funding vote. What kind of action, what kind of responses are you seeing to the latest from Puerto Rico?
So you're seeing a lot of members of Congress, I think, take a lot of action in terms of talking about the issue more. Marco Rubio has been down there once, and I think other members of Congress have as well. There's discussions about how to fund and how to support Puerto Rico. That said, the president himself seems very defensive about the issue, and at times, if you notice his he seems to be tweeting a lot and talking a lot about, say, players in the NFL standing for the national anthem and issues like that. So it's not clear. I mean, my understanding is about something like 80% of the people in Puerto Rico don't have power right now. And if you think about it, 80% of the people in, say, Iowa or Wisconsin that did not have power, I think the president and the Congress would probably be more engaged on the issue than they are now. And I think it might go to the fact, and some of our polling has showed this, that a lot of Americans right now, at least before this crisis, a lot of Americans really didn't know much about Puerto Rico, the fact that Puerto Rico is part of the United States. And I think you're seeing sort of a slower reaction for that reason.
Talking about the top news in national politics this week, Perry Bacon Jr. is with us, political writer for 538.com. I want to spend some time, Perry, on a piece you wrote about Trump administration efforts to roll back policies passed under the Obama administration. What are we seeing there, big picture?
So big picture, if you look at what Obama's overall, 8 years in office, I think that some of the big things were the stimulus bill that was passed, the Dodd-Frank regulation bill, Obamacare, of course, was passed. You had this Iran deal. If you look in the big, I think a lot of the news coverage suggests that you read, because the news tends to cover like what's in conflict and what's happened yesterday. So Trump has rolled back a lot of Obama policies and a lot of Obama ideas. But if you look at the big bills from the last administration and the biggest achievements like Obamacare and like the Dodd-Frank bill, so far Trump has not unwound those. So we did this piece where we asked a few historians and a few scholars kind of what were the top 10 things they felt like Obama did in his 8 years. And what we found is Trump has sort of nipped at the edges of some of those things. He's unwound parts of Obamacare. He's like changed some of the Cuba policy so far. But none of the 10 things that we thought Obama did that were his biggest achievements has Trump gotten rid of yet. I mean, again, Trump may have 3 more years and maybe 7 after that. So it's still early to say. But our piece sort of showed that a lot of the kind of hysteria right now among liberals, particularly that Trump is sort of, tearing about part of everything Obama did is right now not happening. Now, we don't know. There's an executive order that may come out tomorrow on Obamacare that may change a lot of the policy. Also, key thing to remember is things that Trump does through executive order or through his own power are not permanent. The big thing to remember is laws are permanent, like Obamacare until it's repealed by Congress is going to be on the books, which means like President Joe Biden in 2021 could, you know, or what have you, could restart Obamacare in the same way Obama did. So the key thing for Trump, if he wants to really get rid of Obama's policies, is to get laws passed, not just do things in the executive branch.
So a lot of this failure in a way to overturn the big picture items from the Obama administration comes from not being able to work with Congress to get things passed, and which is still obviously a live issue with what we were talking about with Senator Corker.
Exactly. Like the failure, I mean, the first 9 months of the biggest sort of policy story of these first 9 months has to be the repeated and sort of constant, the attempts to repeal Obamacare didn't just fail, they also failed whilst kind of in some ways wasting a lot of time for the Republicans because they couldn't get anything done during that period. So it makes it harder to push anything through. I will note, of course, next week the president is going to make some changes to our Iran policy, and that may be, that was one of my 10 items that I mentioned, was the Obama-Iran deal, and that may, you know, change radically next week.
What are the next big efforts you're looking for from the president and Congress when it comes to overturning the Obama legacy?
So the two things we think are coming forward is there's rumors of some kind of executive action Trump will take on, and the Obamacare issue is the big one overall, what I would say is. There's a lot of talk that of something called a quote-unquote synthetic repeal, in which basically the Trump administration, in the way it uses the executive branch, basically stops or limits or subverts people from enrolling in Obamacare and changes a lot of the rules for Obamacare. So you might get to a point 3 years from now where, no, the Obamacare repeal was not passed in Congress, but the law basically doesn't work the way it did in 2015 because Trump has done so much to sort of undermine that law. Similarly, I think on the Iran deal, the rumors are that next week Trump is going to quote-unquote decertify the Iran deal. And that doesn't necessarily end the Iran deal, but I think you could see a process where Trump continues to potentially escalate things with Iran, Iran withdraws from that agreement, and then you have it unwound because the Iran deal actually is not a congressional treaty. It is something Obama did to some extent on his own, and therefore something Trump could probably unwind on his own.
Perry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
That's Perry Bacon, political writer at 538.com. He joined us to round up some of the top political stories for our weekly look at the latest in national news.
First, Republican and Democratic members of both the state Senate and Assembly are looking for more oversight of the finances of the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King.
And that was reflected in the budget that state lawmakers sent to the governor for his signature. But Governor Walker used his veto power to keep more authority in the executive branch instead of giving it to lawmakers.
Caitlin Farrell has been following developments at and involving the King's Veterans Home. She's a Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter. Caitlin, good to have you back.
Hey, yep, thanks for having me.
So how did the governor's veto pen affect what happens at King?
So, you know, I guess in real time, it doesn't necessarily change anything on the ground, but it does eliminate an extra layer of legislative oversight that both Republicans and Democrats were hoping to impose upon the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, which runs the home. Right now, that agency has the power to move money that King generates into other funds that pay salaries and fund other veterans programs. And lawmakers really wanted to be able to have some oversight so they could see when that happens and maybe prevent that from happening if they didn't think that it was fit. But Governor Walker's vetoes now made that not able to happen. So the agency still has authority to move money as they would like to.
And as you were saying, legislators were looking for more oversight into the finances at King. What was their plan before the veto?
Their plan was to have basically to require the agency to come before the Joint Finance Committee and seek permission anytime they really want to move cash away from King, transfer money from the home into the Veterans Trust Fund. And the trust fund is like a revolving fund housed within the agency, and it pays for a number of programs, and it's had some financial deficits in recent years, but lawmakers really wanted to be able to, in real time, give approval or not to any transfers of money away from the King home as that home continues to bring in more money every year.
What's the procedure right now for the Veterans Home at King when it wants to transfer some of that money to the Veterans Trust Fund?
So right now, they can do it whenever they like. The agency can move money in real time to fund other accounts, to pay for programs kind of as they need to. The cash balance is constantly moving and changing. The agency does put out an estimate of how much they anticipate they might transfer in any given year. They do that. It's an estimate only in the budget that is passed. And then every 2 years, the agency does go back to the committee and then just reports how much they did end up transferring. But right now, there's no mechanism for preventing them from transferring money if they need to. It's sort of just an estimate before the fact, and then they can report what they did after the fact every 2 years.
Now, what did the governor himself have to say about why he chose to use his veto power on this and what he believed was the right thing to do?
So Governor Walker's staff basically said that they felt that giving lawmakers sort of this extra oversight authority would be essentially micromanaging the agency. He thought that process where the agency would have to go back to the committee was duplicating measures that were already in place. And he just reemphasized that he finds that, or his spokesman emphasized that they found that money is veterans helping veterans, that, there's nothing wrong with that. The agency should have autonomy to move money in real time and to have that flexibility as they wish.
We're talking with Caitlin Farrell right now from the Capital Times, looking at the governor and recent vetoes that affect the way money can be moved around at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King, looking at how that money could be transferred away. And this all stems from some problems that came to light in the past year. Caitlin, can you back us up and tell us where the concerns came from?
Sure. So there's been a workforce shortage of nurse aides at King, the King Nursing Home, and other nursing homes in the state. But the problem at King has been particularly acute because of the high level of care that's needed for residents there, and because the nursing home is so large. So there's been ongoing workforce shortages, which, has resulted in compromised care to some degree, according to federal inspections and state inspections. And so I wrote a series of stories last year and have continued to write about, various complaints that residents and their families have had, and noting the types of inspections and citations that the home has received from the federal and state government. And so although there are federal metrics that show that the home is doing well and does perform above average, there's been a lot of questions about, how those inspections are done. And we're still seeing, lawmakers are also seeing some complaints and some concerns from residents that because there's not enough staff there and there's a lot of mandatory overtime, that will affect care.
There have been some tense exchanges between members of the legislature and Department of Veterans Secretary Dan Zimmerman in the past week. What have we heard there?
Sure. So just yesterday, there was a joint legislative audit committee. That's the committee that authorized one large audit of the King home that was released earlier this year. And so there was a committee meeting yesterday to follow up on the results of that audit and to basically ask Secretary Zimmerman whether he would comply with the auditor's recommendations. Lawmakers really pressed him because in the past, that agency has been audited before by the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau, and they haven't always actually completed reports that auditors recommended they complete. And so lawmakers really wanted some specific answers on if the agency would comply and when. And so there are some questions about that and also a series of exchanges just looking at what the agency is doing about the workforce shortage and also the morale of staff there.
And it sounds like the secretary, Dan Zimmerman, he painted a different picture than maybe legislators were seeing. He was saying there has been improvement. He shared some stories. Overall, what was his response to how things are at King?
Overall, he says that things are great. He points, like I said before, he points to what are pretty consistently high ratings from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. That agency regulates nursing homes in Wisconsin and across the country. Those have been higher than average for nursing homes, although we have seen them slip as there's been some citations against the home at King. But Secretary Zimmerman maintains that care at King is great. He said that, you know, since he has taken the helm of the agency, he took the position in February, that things have continued to improve. And he notes that while overtime is still high, and there still is mandatory overtime, he highlighted some initiatives that the agency and he is doing to sort of try to eliminate that and to hire more people. And so, yeah, he was somewhat receptive, you know, to the audit. He wouldn't give any deadlines or specifics on if he would comply with recommendations and when those might be done. But that was basically his response.
And criticism of Zimmerman also came from, we talked about Melissa Sargent, there was also some criticism from Marinette Republican and Joint Finance Committee co-chair John Nygren. What did John Nygren have to say?
So he really took exception to a comment that Secretary Zimmerman made just about whether the legislature should have additional oversight for him to transfer money. So he, along with Governor Walker, says that you know, he shouldn't be micromanaged, that the financial picture at King is constantly being monitored and the agency should have flexibility to move money. He suggested that the legislature really does already have oversight because they receive this report every 2 years, and also that they sign off on a budget in which the agency makes estimates about how much they plan to transfer ahead of time. And so he seemed to suggest that, you know, this was sort of superfluous and not necessary. And, you know, Representative Nygren took exception to that and said that's not the case, that, you know, the legislature does not have any direct authority over how money's transferred. They don't, they're not able to condone it or give it their blessing in real time. And, you know, lawmakers, pretty much most everyone on the committee from both parties, you know, really asserted that they have the right as also elected officials to, and a co-equal branch of government to really oversee what this agency is doing, although not wanting to micromanage it, but they really have the right to be able to monitor these finances.
Well, and the veto left some of that power they were looking for in the executive branch. Is there anything else that they're looking for from a legislative perspective?
They did no one really gave specifics, but several lawmakers yesterday did note that they can pass a bill. Of course, you know, Governor Walker could also veto that bill and he can go through that process as well. But several noted that, yes, you know, they hope that the agency will team with them to be accountable and transparent with money. But they said that they've noted that at any time they could mount an effort to pass a bill that would give them the oversight they were seeking in the budget and maybe compel the agency to submit certain reports on certain deadlines. So no specific proposals or timelines on that were tossed out by any members, but that was noted.
Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Yep, thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell, Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter, joining us to look at the conflict between the governor and legislators and how to provide oversight for the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King.
Coming up, we'll talk to the director of a UW-Madison program that's bringing college-level humanities courses to low-income adults. That's up next on Central Time.
First, for the past 15 years, the UW Odyssey Project has given low-income adults access to college-level education coursework with a focus on the humanities. The goal is to help people get access to college opportunities that would otherwise be out of reach.
Emily Auerbach is director and founder of the Odyssey Project. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
We gave a very nutshell description of the Odyssey Project. Tell us more about it. What did you set out to do?
Well, let me tell you first that it's a good example of how a radio show can change lives. this because my co-founder was actually Jean Faraca. Mm-hmm. She had, as a guest on her radio show here at Wisconsin Public Radio, a reformer out of New York who started a Clementi course in the humanities for low-income adults, showing that if you expose them to Plato and Shakespeare and Socrates and things like that, that transformation can take place. And she was so excited by that, and that was back in about 2000, that she approached me about starting a program here in Madison. What she didn't know is that I would have a personal connection to this idea of giving access to college for low-income adults. Both my parents came out of poverty through Berea College in Kentucky. It's designed for poor people to get a start. And because of that, I didn't want just a great works course. I wanted the whole deal. And so we are trying to take all the students from our 15 years of this project and help them keep going all the way to degrees. We have students who've gone from being homeless to having master's degrees.
Yeah, you've had 15 years now, and congratulations on that, I should say. You're starting to see not just people, you know, succeeding and getting master's degrees, getting jobs and things like that. You're also starting to see second generation people coming through the program. Isn't that right?
That's right. We have three of the students out of our 30 this year who had parents who went through our program. And they say that because their parents started talking about college, it's something that now that they want. We also now have an Odyssey Junior program so that while the parents are with us, we're also working with 50 children aged 2 to 18, giving them intensive literacy and arts training.
And a lot of time when we talk about giving access to education, especially to low-income people, there's a thought that, oh, technical, job skills, things like that. Mm-hmm. You say humanities are a key. Why is that?
Well, obviously the job skills are important too, and we have an emergency fund to help with things like rent and diapers, and you know, I'm not crazy enough to think that Socrates will pay the rent for you. I wish he did. But I think it's also important to tackle inner poverty and to find a way of reaching people in their soul, in their sense of self-worth. And what we do find year after year is that when people read Frederick Douglass's Slave Narrative or Martin Luther King's Letter for Birmingham Jail or poetry by William Blake or by Walt Whitman, something happens, especially because we ask them to write their own poetry and to respond. We turn Ebenezer Scrooge into a modern-day landlord, and we've turned Macbeth into, we've set that in Chicago. And when you make the arts your own, when you take these great writers and figures from the past and understand their struggles, something happens, and we call it a transformation.
Can you talk about some of the people who have gone into this program? Who are you reaching out to, and what do they come with?
We have, for example, one of the men that went through our program some years ago had been born in prison. His mother died in labor giving birth to him. He was in and out of prison himself. He describes himself as a gang-banging thug. But he ended up, first of all, finding religion while he was in prison, and then he found the Odyssey Project. And he said he was reborn. And he is now a minister who is working with men behind bars. We have victims of domestic abuse who are now social workers. We have a refugee from Sudan who just got her master's in social work and is working with families to help them. That's the kind of arc that we see in this program. We have an event coming up on October 26th to kind of celebrate that transformation in costumes, even, uh-huh. Although those are optional. But we call it the Night of the Living Humanities. It's always the last Thursday night in October, closest to Halloween. But we will have students and staff and donors showing up as Socrates or Toni Morrison, or, you know, things like that to kind of show that you can take these figures from the past and make it your own.
And you mentioned, you know, people, this isn't a one and done kind of thing. Talk about how people stay involved with the Odyssey Project, even after they've done the initial coursework.
We have courses for our alumni. We call it Onward Odyssey. And we also have events. And quite frankly, I have alumni in my office almost every day just wanting the encouragement or facing some kind of new obstacle that has happened. You know, if I were married to Bill Gates instead of my husband, and I love my husband, but he's not Bill Gates, but if I were, I would start a 4-year free school for those trying to get out of generational poverty, and we would have built-in housing, counseling, advising, childcare, all those things.
You're not married to Bill Gates. You did get, I understand, a National Endowment for the Humanities grant to help with the Odyssey Junior program you were talking about earlier. What's that going to help you do?
That will give us a foundation for that junior program. And it was exciting because we had a $100,000 challenge match and we were supposed to have 2 years to raise it. But with the change in administration, they were afraid maybe the money would be cut. So we raised it in 2 months with community support. So that was great. But now we got to work on our Onward Odyssey. So that's going to be the target of our October 26th event, is trying to help. What keeps me up at night is worrying about the 400 graduates of the program and how do we keep them going when there's expensive textbooks books, and, you know, we have licensing fees. We had students who are charged to be elected to honor societies. Like, if you get elected to Phi Beta Kappa, there's a fee to be honored. There's a payment sometimes for an honor cord when you graduate. It's just crazy the way we put so many restrictions for those who are really honestly trying to get ahead but lack the resources.
Talking to Emily Auerbach, director and founder of the Odyssey Project, 15 years now and still running strong, it sounds like. Emily, talk about that issue a little more, about access to higher education, a personal story for you and your family, mm-hmm. and then a personal story, obviously, for the people coming through the Odyssey Project. How hard is it for someone without access to something like the Odyssey Project to have a shot at higher education that they can, you know, afford?
First of all, there's a mindset, because, you know, one of my students said that college for him, because no one in his family went to college, it seemed like a chess game where everybody else, it looked like a good game and everybody else was playing, but he didn't know the rules. So part of it is sort of, if you are not from a family that has college kind of built into what they do, sometimes it can seem intimidating. And then there are simply just too many fees and high costs that can get in the way. Also, I have one student in my class from a few years ago who grew up in Madison, went to a high school here, as did I, but she was told, because she was African American, by the guidance counselor, you're not college material. And she talks movingly. In fact, her story is now in the Library of Congress. It was put as part of StoryCorps. We did an interview together. But she talked about what that felt like to watch the white students in their class talk of college, and she was made to feel she wasn't college material. So part of what we're doing, besides the just practical side of helping with the fees for colleges, we're trying to help our students understand their own potential. One of my favorite quotes from an Odyssey student is one who said that the Odyssey Project helped him unwrap his gifts and rewrite the story of his life.
So 15 years, a lot of good results from people, a unique project, but are people around the state or even around the country coming to you saying, hey, can we try to steal some of your ideas?
There was a Odyssey-like Clementi course in Milwaukee. It lasted for 2.5 years and shut down for lack of funding. We do things differently here in Madison. There was also a program that started in Racine and didn't make it. We do have interest from Waukesha and from other areas of the state. I would love to see the program spread elsewhere in Wisconsin. There's a hunger in our communities for access to college and for a warm, encouraging community.
Some of your students clearly are out there doing great things now. What do we lose as a society if we're just taking that talent pool that's out there in among lower-income people, people who were told, mm-hmm. you're not college material, and don't give them that shot?
Well, I think of my parents. My father went on to be, you know, as a Holocaust refugee, he went on to become a research scientist, internationally known. My mother became a reference librarian and social worker. They were written off, you know, in terms of access to college. And we have hundreds of students who are showing just what's possible if you give access. We do have an early bird registration that ends tomorrow for our Night of the Living Humanities event. And I hope people come. I'm hoping to do a better job with my costume. I've had 2 years of failures as Emily Dickinson and Jane Austen, but this year I'm going to try something different.
Can you spoil it for us, or are you going to try for
I'm
the
not going to say that, but I'll say that Emily Dickinson, I was pronounced to look more like Princess Leia from Star Wars, and that for Jane Austen, I was told my bonnet looked like Martha Washington, so I'm hoping to redeem myself this year.
And is Night of the Living Humanities, this is open to the public?
Yes.
And I don't have a website in front of me. Where can people go for information on that?
They can register for it at odyssey.wisc.edu/RSVP, and maybe you can put the link on your website, but our Odyssey website has information, and it's a lot of fun. You don't have to wear costumes, but I'm going to try to redeem myself.
And briefly, just a minute or so mm-hmm. left, what's next for the Odyssey Project?
I would love to see us build more opportunities for our alumni to keep going in school. And so that's my biggest task right now is the Onward Odyssey. We're good with our Odyssey Junior program, with our new grants. We have the new class every year of 30 students. And it's really this growing body of students that want to go all the way to PhDs or master's degrees. And it's like we got something started and now we're trying to keep up with it.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Emily Auerbach, director and founder of the Odyssey Project. We've been talking about the program's educational outreach and impact on low-income adults in the community. That Night of the Living Humanities event takes place on Thursday, October 26th at the University Club in Madison. We will make sure we have a link up on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll have a link to the Odyssey Project so you can learn more while you're there. Tweet us if you've been through the project yourself. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Halloween candy is showing up in stores already, and a new report from candystore.com tells us that Wisconsin has tells us what exactly Wisconsin has liked most recently in the Halloween season.
They track candy sales by the pound. Number one, apparently, in Wisconsin was Starburst, which is one of the candies I least want to eat at Halloween or
it
any other time.
It tends to get stuck in your teeth,
yeah.
doesn't it?
Yeah.
I have that as well. Well, speaking of candies that get stuck in your teeth, number two was the Butterfinger.
Okay. I could accept that. That was once one of my favorites.
Yeah. And number three on the list, Jolly Rancher.
Nope. So it looks like this is measuring just bulk candy sales from this one company. So it doesn't survey all grocery stores and pharmacies and this and that to see all the candies that are sold. I assume if you did that, the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup has got to move to the top of the
list. That's on the top of my list. I have to say, I am baffled and puzzled at Jolly Rancher being number three.
Yeah.
The candy of least resort.
And Starburst, too. I just don't get. I want to hear from you on this. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you want to defend Starburst or Jolly Rancher in the top three of Halloween candy?
And what would your top three be? Let us know. You can let us know over on the Central Time or Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.